Hello, and welcome to another episode of A Legion of Three.
I think you're supposed to say something, Glenn.
What was I supposed to say?
You're supposed to say, this is Glenn.
Oh, I didn't know I was first.
We don't do this often enough for us to have a pattern.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of A Legion of Three,
where the men are men and the sheep are scared.
Where three guys don't know what the fuck they're doing. Okay,
I'm clueless.
I'm spoiler warning.
And if you haven't guessed, we sometimes say some potty language.
Wow.
I'm John.
I'm Glenn.
And I'm Rob.
Good God. What are we doing tonight?
Not wearing pants.
Speak for yourself. I got my pants on.
I have shorts. I don't know what you're talking about, but I was being clear.
Well, today we are going to be covering Garrow stories. So we're going to be doing Garrow, Oath of Moment, and A Legion of One. If you're going by the Garrow book, we're doing chapter 1 and 2, and then chapters 9 and 10.
Why is that?
Because the book is different than the audio drama.
What?
The book has a little bit more detail, a little extra words thrown in here or there that actually add a little bit to it. Because the audio drama leaves a little bit more to imagination sometimes, and the book definitely gets it all out there.
Well, I mean, the audio dramas have a very strict running time, and the books don't.
Mm-hmm. Well, Legion of One was a lot shorter than Oath of Moment.
Well, the most you can fit on a CD is 76 minutes, something, 73 minutes, something like that. So that's the most
ever been
released
as a CD.
They were releasing them on CDs. Yeah, originally, back in the day. They were releasing them on CDs, so you could play them in your car. Because I remember buying a couple at the local G-Dubs.
Crazy. Probably two disc sets.
I don't think so, but I'm not sure. I'm uncertain.
Yeah, you got a point, Rob. They would keep it under the limit for CD.
So right. 76 minutes is an hour and 16.
Yeah. Mm. I think it's like 73, because one of the Metallica albums, this is my record store nerd right here, I think it's Load, advertised it was like 16 or 14 seconds less than the possible length of the CD could be, and I think it was 73 minutes or something. So anyway, I'm sure someone could look that up and be accurate, and we don't care. but I do think, you know, they do work within the limitations of the audio dramas. Another quick sidebar, and this has nothing to do with Garrow, but it does have to do with the audio dramas. In another life, I interviewed Dan Abnett. And he was talking about working stories for the audio dramas and the audiobooks. And he wrote this like super long Eldar name, their natural name, which had like more consonants in a row than you could put your tongue around. And he basically got feedback from the guy reading it going, "What the hell is wrong with you?" in a funny way, because nobody's going to tell Dan Abnett what to do. But he said he did get this note and just thought it was hysterical. That he never thought about that, because, you know, when he wrote it, he was not writing it with the thought that someone had to try to pronounce this mess. I guess it must have been an audiobook, not a drama, because the audio dramas, yeah. I understand they do spend time, you know, literally, you know, the writers themselves sounding things out, because stuff that sounds cool on a paper does not necessarily sound cool when read. And certainly speech is like that, too.
Yes.
Anyway, digression over. Carry on.
All right. So here we go already. A difference between the book for chapter 1 and the audio drama for Oath of Moment. The book starts off on Luna in the Somnor Citadel, whereas the book starts off in Kalth.
Right. Yes. So, yeah, you get kind of this is sort of a prelude and a couple of things. Somnus means sleep. It was, in fact, the Roman god of sleep, I believe, which is kind of cool that you think about the fact that the Sisters of Silence are running the Sleep Citadel. It's really quiet. What else are you going to do? And that people are there kind of an indeterminate amount of time. Eisenstein. I've never actually looked up what that meant. Do you guys know what it is offhand? I do. I'm just quizzing you.
No.
Go ahead, Rob.
It is iron and stone. The iron Eisenstein is German for iron and stone.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What if that has anything to do with the iron and stone men from the Dark Age of Technology?
Garrow is given a new purpose by Malkador. He's basically a man without a legion,
He's sort of reborn. He's basically taken from, he was Death Guard.
Right. He's a traitor, but not a traitor.
Well, the Death Guard turned their back on him, I guess is more correct. They gave up their oath to the Emperor and joined the War Master and the Ruinous Powers, although we don't talk about Ruinous Powers yet. He, you know, stayed loyal, and but he still gives up that allegiance entirely to join the Legion of One, to be Malkador's man, or Marine.
Well, technically, he's the Emperor's agent, but through the hand of Malkador.
So that's a very big recurring theme in here. Malkador, you know, wants Garrow to serve him, and Garrow always makes it clear that he serves the Emperor. And Malkador's like, but I, you know, represent the Emperor, and Garrow's like, sure you do. You know, there's always this little tension between Malkador does have his own things going on, or at least it appears that sometimes he has things going on that are not in the name of the Emperor. And clearly we do see that with the Assassinorum force in Nemesis. You know, the Emperor is not aware of that, and he makes it clear that the Emperor is not involved in sending this assassination team. I know this is a huge spoiler, but it's an 8 or 9 year old book now, so get over it.
Right. You did give spoiler warnings.
That's true. So Malkador is not necessarily entirely in lockstep with the Emperor, and Garrow is aware of that, and that does come up over and over again in these stories.
Yeah, Malkador tells Garrow that he's no longer a Death Guard, and that he's now a ghost, and has Garrow swear an oath of moment to fealty towards Malkador, and Garrow says in his name.
Yeah.
Yeah, so right there, like just like we were saying, he is all, you know, I'm on the side of the Emperor.
So, Oath of Moment, I've never quite understood why they call it that. Do you guys know, and this is not a quiz because I don't know the right answer, why it's called an Oath of Moment? Comes up a lot, but it seems like it's not a moment. This is an oath for life.
Well, think about it like this. At the end of the story, because we'll get to it, there's an Oath of Moment. At that moment, he needed to pledge his fealty.
The name doesn't sit right with me, and I don't know what it is. Because it doesn't seem like, again, I'm not promising you a moment, I'm promising you a much grander period of time.
John's going to Google it for us.
Well, I did. I looked things up before, and I don't know if it actually has a historical reference to it. I mean, you know, I know that soldiers over the years would, you know, swear oaths, a bridge too far, you know, they're gonna take the bridge or die trying.
You know, ours is not to wonder why, ours is but to do or die.
Sure. So I don't know if this is created by, you know, one of the Black Library authors, or if it was created, you know, way back when. You'll have to go back and look through the old Rogue Trader, if you still have your copy of, Rob, and look to see if, you know, they make a mention of any Oaths of Moment.
99% sure it comes from this. Comes from the Heresy, period.
Okay. So it's them swearing to do something else. I remember one of the stories, they said there's a penalty if they fail. I believe it was in Horus Rising, where they all swore their duties. They swore to do certain things, but they also had the penalty if they failed. And they dropped them all into a helmet, and everybody pulled whatever it was out of the helmet and then affixed it to their armor. And if they failed at their task, that was their penance, whatever that was.
For Marines to fail, it typically means they died trying, too, though.
Right.
You either come back with your shield or on it.
Yeah,
right.
To reference another warrior culture. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So Garrow needs a mission. He needs a purpose. And Malkador is giving him a purpose to gather 20 warriors from across all the legions, traitor and loyalist.
Now 20 is a weird number, given there's only 18 legions, right?
Right. Now, okay, but here's another piece there before we get too far. In the book, it says, another agent has drafted a list of names. Garrow suspects Severian, the Lunar Wolf, is the other agent.
I read that, and I went, so he doesn't agree with him, but he doesn't argue it either. He says, it's Malkador's eyes narrowed at the legionary's insight, but he neither confirmed nor denied his suspicions.
Right.
I took that to mean that he was correct, and that Malkador was just a little impressed by Garrow's intuition.
Yeah.
So,
I think so.
Could be completely wrong on that, but that's how I read it.
I'm actually not sure what happens to Severian later, but but that's another story.
He's in Vengeful Spirit. The book, yeah. Vengeful Spirit.
Yeah, but does he die there?
Yes.
I don't remember. Okay.
I believe he does.
Several of them do, but that's another story. We're getting ahead. All right, so Malkador, you know, basically knights him as the Legion of One, the first of Malkador's knights errant, although they don't call them that in the first couple of stories. And he gives him his new armor, which is basically devoid of any markings other than the Sigilite's symbol. And he upgrades his sword to Libertas, which is
Libertas
basically...
Libertas was already a sword.
No, but I mean, don't they make some changes to it? No. I feel like... No? Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's already a mastercrafted power sword, because they certainly talk about it like it's an unstoppable force. Maybe.
Yes. Because his serf brought it. He was taking care of it for him.
Caleb. Right. Okay. Yes.
Polishing the dicks out of it. Yeah.
Yep. Which is weird with a power sword, but whatever. So then we go to Kalth, because we're going to go pick the first person off the list. And he's in the worst war zone in the entire galaxy at the moment.
Yeah. So how does Garrow get there with all the warp storms and everything going on, and he's able to just fly on through like it's nothing? All right, I get my 20 guys, no problem.
Because it's in the script.
Yeah, there's a little hand wave there. the Ruin Storm. All right, the Ruin Storm has not taken full effect yet, because that really does grow through the Shadow Crusade. Again, spoiler warning. Kalth is the start, and Kalth, I think, gets cut off from everywhere else. But I guess he, you know, he's a ship of you know, just like 10 guys. So him and a small crew come roaring in. It doesn't make sense. You're right.
It's a Stormbird. That's all it is.
That
has warp capability.
Stormbird. Yeah.
Something had to carry the Stormbird.
Yes.
It was Malkador. He flew through outer space in tow.
We may be losing the thread here. All right. Moving on. So this is actually, I don't know that it's the first mention of Kalth, but it's certainly written, even though this book comes after Kalth, certainly. Mm-hmm. The several books about Kalth, because it's got like three or four. This is one of the first times where it's really addressed, and some of this stuff has kind of been retconned. I mean, it's not it's vague enough to be accurate, but it certainly gets a lot more detail added in No Fear. I mean, that possibly right. My favorite book in the entire canon at this point, because they drop a cruiser out of orbit. They don't aim it. It literally just falls out of orbit because of all the mess that goes on because of one. Basically, Q-ship that the word bearers throw at them. Anyway, just this, because it's like for several chapters, falling, 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 and then finally touches down and is like a crack of thunder heard around the world. Yeah. So good.
We will cover that.
We certainly should. It'll take us 5 episodes, but No Fear is such a great book.
The spoilers. The word bearers did it to ruin Kalth. The Imperial Fists did it to ruin what's the biggest tank battle place?
Talarn.
Talarn, thank you. Wow. Yeah, the Imperial Fists did it. They dropped one on Talarn because...
Well, it was also an Iron Warrior ship, so...
They don't need this.
Yeah.
They talk about the tidal wave of dirt that came off of that as the ship crashed into the planet's crust. And you know, scoured the planet of tanks and titans alike.
Good times.
All right. So Kalth is being assaulted by the renegade word bearers. They showed up unannounced. And
they were there on purpose. They were planned. It was supposed to be a battle shared between these legions that have beef, that have bad blood between them. Horus was going to bring them together in the good sport of killing somebody else. But then it all turned out to be a lie.
Yeah, Kalth was the muster point, and the Ultramarines showed up, and then the Word Bearers showed up, and the Word Bearers had live ammunition.
Yeah, that's right. Again, such a great story. But all right, so we're setting the scene here. I mean, this is actually a done deal, because we are in the, not end stages, but sort of the next phase of Kalth after most of the word bearers are dead or gone, because some of them did leave. And basically the fighting is going from above ground to underground, and that's really where this story starts off.
Well, it's still early enough that the cultists themselves can survive on the surface, at least for a limited time, because...
They had rebreathers.
Yeah, how else would they throw themselves at the surviving ultramarines without it?
True, but I mean, we're coming up to, again, we're jumping around a little bit. It does, we're coming to the stage where the nuclear winter is basically taking over, and people have to get underground or die to the huge arcologies on Cal.
So we're introduced to Lieutenant Olin of the Ultramar Coalition, and they are fighting monsters, as he describes them, or demons. And they're done. They're dying in droves. And out of the sky comes a gray stormbird. And one legionary jumps out and slays all the demons and saves their day.
These weren't chump demons. I mean, let's be clear. These weren't like... Yeah.
It's like, let's see, what were they the back in the day? Nurglings, maybe? Yeah, or
Well, you know, lesser demons in the of the Ruined Storm, which are not great.
Showing my age there. Blue horrors, pink horrors, maybe?
They're still around.
The little ones with the finger up in the air? I don't think they make those anymore.
Yeah. Actually, I think they do. I probably own some, which, you know, surprises no
I'm sure
one.
You own some from back in the day.
So Garrow jumps out of the Stormbird and does the superhero landing.
Right. Or maybe the Iron Man landing. Yep.
Yeah, right. And then pulls out Libertas and chops all the demons into tiny little gibbets. And then walks up on Olin, and Olin is about to piss his pants.
Right. And says, "You're in charge here. Wasn't a question. I'm looking for Captain Eric Gongias." And before he even knew what he was doing, he was beckoning the guy over. "Hey, we need to find out of this information because Space Marines can make you do things.
Even if you don't know who the hell they are."
Right.
Also, sidebar. Numinous, the city that they're talking about, the capital of Kalth, means supernatural. That seems weird for the Ultramarines, doesn't it?
Yeah, but the Ultramarines didn't name it. whoever created the planet named.
So predating Ultramar, the rise of the 500 worlds. Just a strange, I saw Numinous, and I'm like, I know that means something. And I actually looked it up, and it's supernatural. And I thought, okay, that's a weird, that's a little strange.
I was going to say James Swallow or Dan Abnett named it.
Very possible. Carry on.
So Olin asks, you know, "Who are you? Can you please tell us, you know, the name and rank of the man who saved our lives?" And he says, "My name is Nathaniel Garrow, and as for Legion, I am a Legion of One."
Dun dun dun.
That's cool.
It is. He's definitely, he's both a tragic but also kind of a Rambo figure. I mean, because he can wade into a fight and win because he's such a swordsman and badass.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, he is alone. Even as he does gather these people from Alcador, it never really feels like they're his brothers.
Yeah.
He never really trusts again, I feel like.
Well, you also have to remember that, you know, they're Marines. They were raised as boys.
Right.
Young boys, trained, indoctrinated to become a Marine, fighting alongside other Marines for their entire life. And now they are thrust into this, he is thrust into this solitary environment of
loneliness. I mean, yeah, so they talk about in, I think it's the first Heretic, the difference between Marines and Custodes, besides the fact that Custodes are, you know, just bigger, badder, whatever, is that they fight as individual warriors and Marines fight as packs. Marines are pack animals. They fight as a wolf pack, although, you know, that has too much connotation.
Right. As squads, yeah.
Yeah, but they're trained to fight as brothers, whereas every custode is an army unto himself, but also he has no interaction with his brothers. You know, they fight alone. And Garrow now is fighting like a custode more than he's fighting like a Marine.
So the 21st Company of Ultramarines are under attack by the Word Bearers, Brotherhood of the Knife, cultists, and they're trying to just bog down the Ultramarines, just bog them down, make them waste all their ammo, and then they're going to send in the heavy stuff. Now, the 21st Company recently lost their apothecary, Milas, and we meet Rubio, who's standing guard, and his captain comes up to him and tells him, "Hey, we gotta give our brother his due." And because Rubio is questioning whether he did the right thing or not. He doesn't know if he should be over there because he could have saved his brother's life.
It's interesting because, you know, we don't immediately know what he's upset about. That there's something wrong with Rubio that just does not jump out exactly as to what he's upset, and he's missing a piece of himself, basically. And it comes out, you know, eventually that he is an ex-librarian, that he was one of the librarians that after Nikea, you know, put away his powers and rejoined the ranks. But it's a hole in him that he's missing.
Yeah, so he was a codicer, which is one step down from a librarian. So pretty powerful.
Yeah. The librarian is the whole, not, it's the, like the chaplaincy. I don't know what you call it.
Well, I always thought it was epistolary, codicier, and then librarian.
I think they're all librarians.
Yeah, they're all librarians.
They're okay. Of the librarius. I don't know. I mean, some of this too hasn't been talked about in a while. Like now, in more recent editions, you're a librarian. And I guess that's true even in the Heresy. If you're a Centurion Council librarian instead of whatever. Mm-hmm. Anyway, yes. So he was at least a moderately powerful psyker who, you know, Guliman said, all right, the Emperor doesn't want us to use psychics anymore. Stop being psychers, people.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, okay. Yeah. Which it's funny because there are definitely groups that ignore that entirely. The Thousand Sons, absolutely. The Space Wolves, we're not psychers. We follow the weird, man. It's cool.
Right.
But the Ultramarines, and then just as a quick sidebar, the worst offender, I think, was the Imperial Fists, who basically locked all their psychers in a hole deep inside of their Space Fortress Monastery.
Right.
And said, we'll let you out eventually.
Which is another Garrow story.
Think about what you've done.
I'm going to need you, so I need you to be here.
Yeah. In this room, locked away, we'll slide you food under the door every now and again. Bye-bye.
Here's your Regicide game board and some playing cards, and we'll see you later.
Some old magazines that we got at the doctor's office. Yeah. I mean, it's just, that's terrible. At least these guys, the Ultramarines got to go back to the squads and do stuff. Those guys literally just got locked up.
But all the ones they described, they made them rank and file. I was like, wait a second. Wouldn't they be like a sergeant or a lieutenant? Not rank and file.
Just because you're a psyker doesn't mean you have good leadership skills. You just can't kill people with your brain.
Wow.
Give him a sword. You already know he knows how to wield one.
That's true. Yes.
At least make him an assault marine or something. give him a sword.
Put him on latrine duty.
So one of the things that is different from the book compared to the audio drama, they describe Garrow running from when he left the Ultramar Coalition in Olin all the way to where Rubio and the 21st Company is. And he's describing the sights that he's seeing and how the world's decaying.
It's pretty horrific to see what's become of Kalth. Kalth, which was the jewel of Ultramar, the jewel of the 500 worlds. Although I don't feel like they even say 500 worlds in this story, is now just garbage. It's just, you know, so many horrible things have happened. You know, ships falling, orbital bombardments, mass bloodletting, you know, just horrible, horrible things have happened to this once beautiful place, which, you know, is what happens through the Shadow Crusade to all of Ultramar, or at least many parts of it.
Yeah. So Garrow comes striding into where the 21st Company is, you know, bunkered down in a tunnel, you know, leading to Numinous. And he just strides right on in. They got guns drawn on him, everything. Hey, you're hard to find.
I guess he doesn't really know, you know, how bad the Ultramarines have gotten their rear ends kicked. They have every reason not to trust anybody who's looking at them. And he just strolls in.
Yeah. Do, 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 do. Oh, let me put my gun down. Here, I clip it to my shoulder.
Yeah, there we go. I'm cool now. You can trust me. Trust is in deep supply right now, right?
Yes. Yeah. And Captain Gaius lets Garrow know I'm in charge here. And he goes, I'm not going to dispute your command, but the higher authority is mine. He leans forward and he goes, see? They all see the stylized eye. Now, they describe it as being over his shoulders. But I have a model of Garrow. There is not a stylized eye hitting on his shoulders. There's one on his pauldron.
But yeah, it's I guess they decided that didn't work as a model, and it is kind of a weird design aesthetic. I don't know.
So I kept thinking it was, you know, between his pauldron and his neck on his shoulder, and it was small.
That's like a weird tattoo place.
Right. Basically, you know.
So kind of like a modern day Grey Knight would have a little kind of shield, flipping shield there.
Well, not in the front. It was up high on the shoulder. So he had to lean forwards in order for them to see it.
Hmm.
And did they just do on one side or do you want on both sides? You know, it sounded like they only did one, but it just made me wonder exactly where they put it.
Yeah.
Garrow's manner hardened. I do not dispute your command, but the higher authority here is mine. See? He bowed slightly, and by the glow of the lumens, a hidden rune across the shoulders of his plate suddenly became visible. Rubio saw a stylized eye, scribe encoded into the atomic lattice of the Ceramite sheath by Mizan Beam, the sigil of Malkador. He knew the symbol. They all did. It was the personal mark of the Regent of Terra, and those who bore it were the proxy to the Emperor's closest confidant. The rune would allow this Garrow to go where he wished, and as the instrument of Malkador's will, to countermand any order, even that of a ranked officer. The sharp intake of breath from Captain Gaius told Rubio that his commander shared his thoughts. So, go on, Glenn.
So, Rubio thinks that Garrow is there for his captain, and that they're being watched and judged by Terra. Well, when in fact, Garrow is there for Rubio. Rubio is trying to find out what is going on, and so he's thinking about letting up just a little bit, just so he can kind of get a measure of who Garrow really is. That's where he has a foreseen, and he sees his captain being killed. And now he's freaking out. Like, uh-oh.
Shouldn't have done that.
And of course, you know, the word bearers are coming and attacking, and in comes a huge, monstrous, six-legged behemoth monster creature tank, which in the autodrama, they do not describe what it is. In the book, they use the word defiler. I didn't think defilers were out in in 30K.
Yeah, they're not playable, but, you know, there's lots of stuff that gets thrown around in Black Library and even the Black Books that never has model availability, so.
Well, there's other stories with the Dark Mechanicum that are, you know, they basically build the prototypes for all of the things that are now present in modern 40K. So, I pictured a filer as well. That's probably what the author was looking at. Either that or, what is it, the Brass Scorpion, and then there's something else too, isn't there?
Yeah, there's yeah, but those are the two big tank things that they make. The other stuff is all either dreadnoughts or like drone things.
Yeah. So the Defiler comes in, it kills the captain, just as Rubio foresaw, and Garrow jumps on top of it, stabs it with Libertas, the sharpest sword in the world, and you know, proceeds to stun it while the heavy weapons guys get into position and blow it up. Pretty interesting.
Yeah. It's pretty good to chop a defiler in half with a sword. I mean, you know, why not?
Well, strength 4. Strength is user.
Lots of sixes.
From the back, you need a 6 just to glance it. I mean, he didn't destroy it. He didn't stun it. That makes sense. You could stun. Yeah, okay.
Sure.
Okay.
Pretty sure in the rules it says strength as needed.
Strength as needed.
Well, if he's holding it one-handed or two, because that's a thing, too, sometimes.
It was like, definitely okay. Too handy because he reversed it in his grip and stabbed down with it. Yes.
Put the bolt pistol away, double hand the sword. All right, now it's on. Now we're serious. No, it's cool. It's very cool. I mean, it's a very cool scene.
Yeah. So they fight back and push back destroy that, and it kills the rest of the cultists. And now they're, you know, rearming and getting ready. And now the word bearers are coming and they see Terminators coming, and they keep, you know, the Ultramarines keep falling back with Garrow. I skipped a point here. Garrow tells Rubio, I'm here for you, that we need to go now if we're going to get out of here. And Rubio lets him know, no, I defy you and Malkador. I choose to stand with my brothers. And Garrow says, well, then we choose defiance together. So now the word bearers attack, and they're getting pushed back and pushed back. And Rubio is forced, but not really. He chose to wait to this point to really use his powers to unleash lightning, break up the ground, wipe out the Terminators, and crush them under a cave-in as we're retreating into the cave system. Rubio is, you know, beside himself because he's like, look what you made me do. And Garrow says, no, you've already made this decision. You just don't know that you made this decision previously.
Which is kind of a cop-out answer, but
Right. You only realize now that you chose to do this. And as Rubio goes to check on his brothers, or you know, his battle brothers, they all turn their backs on him. Just instantly. Okay, see ya. Not, hey, yeah, thanks for saving our lives. Peace out. But, you know, no.
You
just
broke with the Emperor, buddy.
Yep. You broke the edict. You are gone.
Even
broke
if you over. Saved our lives.
Right.
And all this other stuff. Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of, it kind of shows you the Ultramarines being inflexible jerks.
Right. He broke a decree absolute, were the exact right. words. No forgiveness is allowed.
That's fine. I'm going to go join another legion.
So Garrow pulls out the sword. And for a brief second, I think Rubio thought maybe he was getting ready to get his beheaded.
Yeah.
But.
Gotta put you down, son.
Garrow demands an oath of moment. And reluctantly, Rubio agrees.
And we have the first of 20 checked off on our list.
Or was Garrow number one? And this
no,
is now
I think
number two.
It's a list of 20.
How do you know Garrow's name wasn't already on the list?
Hold up. How do you know Garrow is the first?
Garrow's not the first. Right. We already know Garrow's not the first.
Well, he said an operative. He may not have meant another space marine. But what I was going at is we know that there was the... It's been a long week.
Give him a list of 20 if there were people on there that are already in. What? That's a dumb list.
He could have already tried a couple of times. What I'm trying to get at is the story we did before with the Death Guard and the Imperial Fists and the one guy that was in gray and he died blowing
right.
up the ship.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you. Can't remember anything at the moment. It's been a really long week. But that guy could have been the first.
Like Archbold or something.
On a mission for Malkador and he failed. And now Garrow is now the number two.
He died, therefore he failed. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's
an interesting angle I had not considered before. Mm-hmm. That Garrow, as important as he is to, I mean, a lot of things, you know, he may not have been the first. He may have just been the most recent and
right.
later the most successful agent of Malkador.
Right.
We know there's other missions that Malkador is sending other people on because there's the story about where they go and rescue the Mona Lisa and the Rosetta Stone. From somebody's personal collection to then save it before Horus reaches Terra so that it doesn't get destroyed so that some of the humanity's history gets preserved. Do you remember that story?
I do not.
I don't either.
Oh.
Where is that? What is that from? You got to find that.
There's another story. It's a human operative. He's part of like the Solar Exilia or, you know, the, like human Terrans. But Malkador basically recruits them to go do this job. And a bunch of people die on the mission, and they open up the crate to see what is so important that all these people had to die. And it's the Mona Lisa and it's the Rosetta Stone in the different crates. And
interesting.
Malkador's like, you know, this stuff needs to be preserved. It's important. So
yeah, that's cool. You gotta find out what the name of that story is because I'd like to read it. Because as much as you just spoiled it,
I did give you a spoiler warning.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Whatever.
So in the next story, we meet Mesa Varen.
By the way,
who's a word bearer. who's a word bearer. And I'm not a word bearer, excuse me. Mesa Varen, who is a world eater.
Thank you.
He's not on the list.
No.
Garrow recruited him. You know, as they say in the next story, he's ill-fitted. He doesn't like it.
Well, you know, world eaters are not good for anybody but themselves. And even then, you know, they're a legion apart. Even the ones who stayed loyal to the Emperor are still bloodthirsty, crazy sons of bitches.
They
love them so
cuddles.
Much.
They just need cuddles.
I just love me some world leaders. Always have. Literally, John knows from the Rogue Trader days, world leaders. Booyah. Yeah. Although I had yet to play them in 30K, and if Games Workshop, if you're listening, and I know you're not, plastic assault marines for 30K. That's all I ask. I will do the biggest world eater legion ever if you just put out some plastic assault marines.
Wow.
Thank you.
All right. So let's move on to our second book.
Story. Let's not read a whole book.
Well, short story, part of the same book, I guess. All right. Let's move on to our second story.
Thank you.
Which is chapter 9 and 10. Audio Drama calls it Legion of One. So this one takes place on Istvan 3. Pretty interesting to come back to this place.
But we don't know if Istvan 3 until we're, unless you piece all the pieces together.
Yeah, I I managed to do that, but I guess I got lucky for once.
You're right. It doesn't say that it's Tavon 3. I was just trying to think about that. I'm like, I know it is because of who we find there and kind of the discussion, but
you got to put the pieces together later.
Yeah. You're right. Okay. Carry on.
So we meet three warriors. Well, first things first, they described a little bit of the heresy, and it described how this planet was just decimated by treachery, and that this was the birthplace of the rebellion. So now then we meet three warriors, Garrow, Rubio, and Mace Varen. Garrow informs the two of them that this is the last recruit. This is the last guy we got to get.
So we've missed a lot of recruits.
Right, between chapters 1 and chapters 10.
Yeah. We've skipped around a bit. So right. There's either other agents that are involved, or there's just a lot off scene, off camera, which both can be true.
Right. And it doesn't necessarily mean Garrow went and got all the guys. Right. Other people could have went and got some of them.
He's too important to risk on all 20, or however many there are remaining. Anyway, but yes, this is the last one, and this is one of the worst places in the galaxy to go find somebody.
Right. Two of the three of them had just left here just a little over a year ago.
Right.
Like, why in the world do we want to be back here? So then next we're introduced to Cerberus.
Yes.
Next we're introduced
to
Cerberus.
The Hound of Hell.
Yes. And I instantly knew who Cerberus was from Greek Roman mythology. And I was like, okay. And then he even calls himself that at one point in time. The Wolfhound at the Gates of Hell. He is obviously crazy. Mad. He's defying gravity. He's standing there like, come on, take me. Kill me. Take me. I'm ready to die. I've already died once. I'm not going to die again. Or kill me again. Who cares?
Yeah. What's the worst you got?
Yes, he's talking in kind of circles.
I've been through a lot, man.
Right. And the one thing he says he knows, that he truly knows, is the Mark of Three. If he understands anything, it is that. Which I never thought of as that big of a deal when I've listened to the audio drama. But when I actually read through it and read it, it was like, wait a second. This is important. It's not huge, but it's important, because I personally didn't piece those two pieces together. I was able to figure out they were in Istvan 3, but I couldn't piece that part together.
Not until the later reveal, yeah. I mean, once that happens, it becomes very clear what the mark is that he's talking about.
Right.
Spoiler warning. It's Nurgle. Yeah.
He's so driven mad, he doesn't recognize his own face. He doesn't even know his own name.
He has endured kind of a lot. He's on what is now a charnel world. I was going to say a death world, but that means something else in this millennium.
He's
in a world of like human ash everywhere.
Right.
You can taste it on the wind.
Right. You can't not taste it. Is the problem? There's probably no clean air anywhere that's not tainted by burnt something, whether it's terrain, buildings, or people, and mostly it's people.
They describe that, Cerberus is standing on the cliff, and then he sees out in the distance some foes, his prey. And so he just jumps, and he kills them all. And he's like, I'm alone.
Yep. Yeah. You can't be here. This is just me. This is a soliloquy. Right.
So there was a TV show that came on, I think it was on CBS. It was called Jericho. Did either of you ever watch it?
Did not.
I've seen a couple episodes.
Okay. One of the first episodes... there's a nuclear strike on American soil, and I think Jericho is in Colorado, I think, or somewhere near Colorado, one of the neighboring states. And the people come out of their shelters after the nuclear strike, and there's this weird snow that's falling down. It's kind of gray. And, the teenagers are like holding their hands out and catching some of it in their hands. And, one of them goes, what's all this? And one of the grizzled old veterans says, Denver.
Oh. That's going to leave a mark.
Yeah. So with all the ash and stuff, the bombardment and whatnot that they punished Istvan 3 with, a lot of that is, like you said, human ash. And anything that was alive on the planet previously has been reduced to ash. One thing that I would point out, and in retrospect, when he said his name was Cerberus, I was like, well, wait a minute, doesn't Cerberus have three heads? But then, spoilers, it comes out later that his brain, his mind, has split.
Right.
So he has Cerberus, this identity that he's created. He has his original self, which we'll get to that in a few. And then he actually has a dead friend, basically, that he's concocted in his mind. We're going to see him here in a few minutes, too.
Everybody needs a little company.
Right. So I thought that the name of Cerberus was actually pretty apt, considering that at this point in his mind, he's actually three separate people.
But he can't access the one that's himself.
Right.
And when he tries to, he endures incredible pain trying to recollect and trying to remember. It hurts him. He even tells the other, you know, I will take the pain. I will tell the story and I will take the pain. So our knights errant come across a dead militia, and Garrow finds a trinket on one of them. And Garrow plucks it with his fingers and he says the words out loud, "The Emperor protects." And Rubio, being a psyker, says, "Those were his last thoughts. How could you possibly know that?"
Yeah. That's a really uncomfortable moment, I think, right there. It's like, what is going on that you should know that or think that?
Right. And we all know it's because Garrow is a follower of the Letitia Divinitatis.
He's a believer now. Yeah. Yes. I mean, he's been through enough to be a believer. He kind of had that belief beaten into him on the Eisenstein.
Right. Especially having Keeler around.
Yep.
When Keeler was able to banish demon that had manifested, you know, just from her belief in the Letitia Divinitatis, it kind of solidified that in his mind.
Yep.
So Garrow and his band, they find some humans alive. They can't believe it. Like, wait a second, where are these people coming from? And so they tell their story, and the leader, he called himself Arcudi, says he was part of a Titan crew that got beheaded early in the battle, and they got way underground. And they're afraid of this beast that keeps coming and killing them all. And then when they try to go fight it, it kills them. And of course, Garrow, you know, "We're going to protect you," because, you know, the guy says the Emperor protects. And Garrow instantly jumps in. "All right, cool. We're going to protect you. We're going to make sure you're safe." Even though Varen is 100% against it. It's like, wait, no. We can't protect these guys. No, we got our mission.
Right. We're here for one reason only.
Yes. To get number 20. So, of course, Garrow, he agrees to help. And, you know, he scolds Varen. "I'm in charge. I get to make, you don't know the letter of Malkador's order. I'm in charge. This is what we're going to go do. We'll take the fight to the beast." So Garrow and Rubio go in to find the beast in a broken down basilica. And in there is Cerberus, but he's talking to his headless friend, trying to get answers and getting nowhere with him. But then here's the...
Not real talkative headless people.
Usually not. Garrow finds that out too when he's walking in there and goes, "Turn and face me."
Yeah.
Ruby will be like, "It'll be a horror if he does."
Yeah, that's right. Oh, my bad.
Absolutely. Thanks. I'm glad he didn't turn around. That would have sucked.
Yes. We would have had bigger problems.
So we have Cerberus heard them coming. So he hides. He comes out of nowhere, hits Rubio, throws a crack grenade, which Garrow, you know, aptly grabs it and throws it into a sinkhole, and the whole basilica comes down on him. But Cerberus got away.
Now I was going to call bullshit on this, but, you know, it's in the plot, so we're going to allow...
Well, you know, crack grenades are powerful, and the place was already marginal. Sure.
Didn't they describe crack grenades as being the size of a coin?
Yeah. Sure. But they could still have a lot of explosive potential, even in a small package. I mean, that explains you, John.
Oh, jeez.
Walked right into that. I really appreciate it, though.
Cerberus goes, runs out, and he grabs Varen. He's on riding the dust in the wind and just bounds right on in, knocks Mesa Varen senseless, grabs his bolter, and just starts shooting up all the humans. Wait a second, why is he shooting innocent
doing
people?
A terrible job of defending. Let's know.
Right. This is supposed to be a world eater who's supposed to be really good at hand-to-hand combat. He just got punked.
But also, world eaters are not here for defense. I don't know what they were thinking to put him in charge of defending. He should have been the one attacking at all times.
Yes.
Okay. I don't have the book in front of me at the moment, but basically, I remember them saying at some point, he doesn't fight like a Marine. So.
Right. No. He fights with no abandon
He's
of
all
himself.
Offense. Yeah.
Right. Okay. He most Space Marines fight to win and survive. He was just fighting to win. He didn't care about his survival.
About, they talk about the fact that his chain sword is just basically, you know, like half the teeth are gone and whatever.
It's a club, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a cool image to see this, you know, berserker thing just sort of, you know, twitching madly with a club chain sword and still knocks down the world eater. I love it.
Right. Reminds me of how they described Conrad Kerr's fighting.
Yes.
Against
right.
the lion and, what was it? Gilliman. It was two of them. I can't remember which two. But basically, he wasn't fighting to survive. He knew he wasn't going to die there. So he was taking wounds left, right, and center, but he was giving what he got.
Right, right. Yeah, he fights with absolutely no care in the world because he knows his death is far off at that point. And he doesn't fight like an honorable soldier either. He fights like a backstreet throat slasher. So, yeah.
Right.
Like, you know, all the good Night Lords do.
All right.
Tee-hee.
Yep. Moving on.
So out of nowhere comes a smiting blast from Rubio onto the ground and into Cerberus. He gets knocked and falls into the ground and disappears. You know, is he dead? Of course not. There's no body.
Where did he go?
Yeah, he's not dead. So the aftermath of the attack, they're checking on the wounded, and Arcudi's refusing any kind of medical treatment, and the same for his people, no medical treatment. Well, Rubio starts looking around because he thinks the guy's lying to him. So he's looking around, and he grabs one of the lady's arms and lifts her sleeve and sees marks of three. And he checks another one and another one and another. And sure enough, it is the mark of Nurgle. He asks Garrow, hey, do you know what this is? And Garrow's like, oh, yes, it is the Herald of Ruination and Abomination.
I wish you hadn't found that.
Yep. You weren't supposed to see that.
You've seen it before, both as they fled on the Eisenstein and also on the Song of Citadel with his friend that turned into a greater demon of Nurgle.
Right. And the guy, because, you know, Garrow never told him his name, says, you know, the grandfather's looking for you or waiting for you, Nathaniel. So basically, Nurgle's got his eye on Garrow. It's like,
the one who got away. Yeah.
I'm going to get him. And the humans, or the demons, you know, however you want to put it, they rear their head back and, you know, cry for help, cry for their kindred, other monsters, and they start coming. And Garrow and Baron and Rubio are all going to combat wheel formation to try to protect themselves. And there's just too many. Way too many. But out of nowhere comes Cerberus.
Cerberus.
Taking heads, lopping off heads, lopping off arms, killing left and right. Just like a good Space Marine does. And after they're all dispatched, it's down to the four Space Marines.
I like that bit in here. You did not look in his eyes, Psyker Spat Baron. You did not see what I did. Torment and blackness. Can your witch sight divine that? He struggled to articulate himself. My words before, I was wrong. He is a beast, a man become an animal. But he is still one of us. He is not a traitor. And then Mesa Baron says, I could not touch his mind, admitted the Psyker. The turmoil there is too strong, like a great maelstrom. So his brain's messed up.
It's like talking to three people at once. It's a crazy party line in there.
He's got all the marbles. That's crazy.
That's right. He hasn't lost his marble. He's just gained more. They're all rattling together.
Yeah. So he can't hear nothing else going on inside his own head.
Yeah. But where the World Eater and the Ex-Ultramarine fail, the Legion of One will prevail.
Well, this one's called Legion of One because Cerberus calls himself a Legion of One.
But also, that's a name that's been taken by Garrow.
Garrow said, I'm a Legion of One back in the first story.
So. Yep,
right.
So they're going to have a fight. There can be only one Legion
of One.
There can
be only one Legion of One.
That's right.
I'm the other Legion of One.
Time to draw.
Yeah.
Look at this pretty sword I drew. It's lovely. It's got good definition. It's this joke works really well in an audio format.
So Garrow basically tells him, if you kill me, then you are indeed the traitor.
I think we missed an important point.
Okay.
I'm going to read here. As their swords met, clashed, and met again, Garrow saw this lost soul for what he truly was. Through a hurricane of blows, sparks leaping as metal ground on metal, he glimpsed fragments of the man behind the madness. Garrow was tested with every attack and riposte. He knew in an instant that this was one of the most lethal foes he had ever faced in the arena of blades. Every strike parried, every lunge met in kind. Warrior to warrior, they fought and fought. Time stretched until there was only the moment, and the fight caught within it. They struggled back and forth, seeking tiny nicks and cuts, but never finding the defining blow. Each was the equal of the other. They battled on in search of the single fractional instant of inattention that would mean a death strike. Garrow once fought, in one of the other stories, a custodian.
Well, but he's not trying to kill this man. That is a fact here, too. He is on the defensive. But, and I'm just going to say his name now, Loken is, you know, every legion has their premier swordsman. And I feel like Loken is that for, it's probably between him and Abaddon, because Abaddon is pretty badass.
Little horses, too.
But I don't think he's on the same level as these two. I think Loken and Abaddon were the premier swordsmen of the legion. So this is one guy who's not trying to kill his opponent. The other guy trying to kill him, but he's got, you know, garbage equipment, and his armor is probably, you know, not full power and everything else. So, yeah, it just shows you this Clash of the Titans and what it would be like if Loken were A, in full possession of himself, and B, not dealing with garbage.
Right. Now, Loken also...
He would have killed Garrow, probably.
Loken, in one of the other stories, he beat Lucius.
Yeah, who is the best of a legion that prides itself on their swordsmanship, the Emperor's Children.
Well, he beat old Lucius. He didn't beat,
Yes, Chaos enhanced. Yeah. But at the same time, Lucius was an incredible swordsman. His only downfall was his incredible ego.
Right.
Yep.
That's how Loken beat him. He didn't beat him his technicality, I guess.
Right. He punched him right in the face.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
That went around and I don't think he ever was forgiven for that. I always feel like Lucius hated his guts for being unsportsmanlike. But, you know, Lucius has his issues. I feel like in another episode we went through and talked about some of the leading fighters of different places. You got Sevatar, you've got Dag Nabbit, you have his equerry, Karn.
Yeah.
Although Karn is certainly not they talk about the fact that he loses in the training cages as often as he wins because he doesn't care. He knows that that's not a real fight on the battlefield. Karn is unstoppable. You know, no one could best him.
Unless you hit him with a Land Raider.
Hey, he got back up. He got back up.
Only after Chaos Gods possessed him.
The Land Raider hurts. That's a lot of pain. Who is it for the Ultramarines? Who's the swordsman?
I don't know.
It's Raldoran for the Blood Angels.
And Sigismund for the Fists.
Argaltal for the Word Bearers. Oh, what's his name from the Raven Guard?
I know you're talking about, but I can't think of his name.
Yeah, he's really impressive. He's like the Shadow Sherokin. Sherokin.
Sure. Yeah.
Sherokin.
Yes, he's such a badass. And I don't think the Raven Guard are interesting most of the time, but like him by himself is awesome. All right, sorry, let's get back to the story. I know I'm off track. So, yes, you do have here a clash of two of the best warriors of the legions, and it was no sure thing. I mean, even with one not trying to kill the other one, his survival was no guarantee.
Yeah, Loken not knowing himself, and... Garrow now trying to save him as opposed to kill him. Because at one point in time, Garrow was like, we need to put him down. But he changed his mind. And like I was saying before, basically, if you kill me, Garrow drops his sword. You kill me, you're killing a brother. And that makes you the traitor. And that kind of unlocks the final key unlocking his mind. And he says, well, who am I? And he goes, you are Garvial Oaken, and this is Istvan III. And this is where your Primarch and your Legion betrayed you.
Yeah, it is kind of a hand wave how he gets himself back together. But he does. I mean, Loken basically is given the choice between killing Garrow or facing who he really is. I mean, and it turns out he got lucky that he didn't instead behead Garrow. Like, nope, still service.
What'd you do? I aim for the head.
That's right. I told him I was going to kill him. Now I killed him. Boom. That's right. Deal with it.
Told you I'm going to kill you for that.
So, if you didn't realize it before, the headless corpse would be Torgadin.
Right.
Taric Torgadin, who was the other member of the Mournival who was betrayed. And he died, and then Loken was buried alive in the collapsing rubble.
Right.
But also, Torgadin, his body then... wasn't he the one that got...
Yes, he later becomes possessed by a demon who becomes Tormageddon, I believe.
Tormageddon, yeah, something like that.
Terrible. Just terrible.
It is. It's a mess. But it's... And the worst part is, he is the dark reflection of Torgadin, and they actually do meet up in the Siege of Terra. I don't know if you guys have read that far yet.
No, I have not.
Oh, it's quite a confrontation when Loken meets Tormageddon, excuse me.
Which book is that one in?
Saturnine.
Okay, I have that
I'm pretty sure.
I have not finished it.
Garrow and Loken feature very heavily in Saturnine, which is cool.
Cool.
It's my second favorite book of the whole Heresy, I think.
Okay, cool. I'll finish it. I have it. I just haven't finished it yet.
No worries. I mean, and both of them are by Dan Abnett, who is my favorite writer that GW has. So, it's the whole thing. Second place, ADB. Love you, man.
So, Loken asks Garrow, so what's next? What are we doing now? And Garrow tells him, you were my last recruit. The rest we're going to find out together. So they're going back to Terra to learn about what's going on.
What's next? What is Malkador doing? Why does he need these 20 Marines or so?
Right.
And that is another story. Or, a bunch of them.
So, is there any overlap between the guys that are there? Because he picked 20 out of the 18 legions. Did he pick one from each legion?
It's got to be more than one for some.
Well, we know Sepharadin is a lunar wolf, and Iactin Kruz is a lunar wolf, and
so is Loken.
Loken is a lunar wolf.
Okay, you guys missed my innuendo there. So he picked 20 Marines out of the 18 legions.
Right.
And we know the Forgotten and the Purged.
Right.
When those two legions were removed. The other legions got bigger. Other legions got bigger, especially the Ultramarines. Mm-hmm. So it's possible that what Malkador has collected here is 20 loyal Marines from each of the original 20 chapters.
Right.
So I don't remember, there's no loyal word bearer that gets collected, is there?
Well, is there?
I don't, not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
I don't know. That either. The 20 revealed.
There was one on Terra, and they
put sacrificed him.
Cell. Yeah, what's that?
They sacrificed him.
Yeah. That's the only one I could think of that would have been around, but no. I think the majority of the word bearers went.
Yeah. They were pretty lockstep with Lorgar.
Yeah.
He never had to thin their ranks out, although... So there's we have a little time. There's an interesting discussion about Kalth that came up on Reddit, and I'm going to crib from it a little bit. Kalth was never meant to destroy the Ultramarines. We don't know exactly how many Ultramarines died on Calth. It's an unknowable number because it probably varies from book to book as to how many really died. But it was a lot. I mean, we can clearly see many right. Ultramarines died on Calth. Many more died in the Shadow Crusade.
I have the exact figure right here. It's a shit ton.
It's a good metric shit ton.
John counted every page. And here's what we came up with. A shit ton of Ultramarines.
That's a lot of Ultramarines.
The point is that he actually was thinning the ranks of the Word Bearers by sending them to Calth, because that was a suicide mission. He never expected anybody to come back from Calth, which is so funny that he sent Erebus. Erebus just cheated his way out. Well,
everyone hates Erebus.
Everyone does. So he actually sent his most untrustworthy, not from a loyalty perspective, but just from their self-control perspective, to Cal. I mean, he was basically refining his ranks more than he was culling them. So he sent, you know, the craziest of the crazies, the ones who he didn't think could be trusted to stick to the War Master's plans. And they worked fine as cannon fodder, well, whatever you want to call it, for Cal. But he sent a much smaller number to take out a much larger number of Ultramarines, and through surprise and all the underhanded stuff that they did a great job. And again, they killed a shit ton of Ultramarines. But it is interesting to see that he didn't throw his whole legion there, even though they all really had, you know, such animosity towards the Ultramarines. He just threw a small portion of them, and it was the ones who were his quote-unquote problem children. He certainly didn't send any of the Gall Vorback.
Right.
The Chosen. Anyway, interesting. It was an interesting side piece, I thought, about what really went down at Calth, and what the true goals were. And it wasn't annihilation. It was a big distraction, mostly, to keep Ultramar away from Earth. Which works. Yeah. Worked pretty damn good.
Yeah, because you think back of... when Istvan 4, right? Istvan 4?
Three and 5, isn't it?
3 and 5, okay. So when Istvan 5 happened, that was way before Calth.
It's not way, way before. I think it's in the Black Books. It's close. It's just the news.
It can't be too far, because otherwise the Ultramarines would have known about that they were traitors already and would have greeted them as so.
Right, because
but yeah, I guess it can't be too far. I don't know why else they could go so far.
Most of the Word Bearers were at Istvan V.
Right,
they were the reinforcements that turned on the brothers.
Right,
they were part of. And yeah, so that news hadn't come out yet. But it's weird, and I don't and there's books I haven't read yet, so I don't know. There's a lot that disappears between what happens at Istvan and Calth, and then the Word Bearers kind of go dark. I mean, they're involved in the Shadow Crusade, but I haven't got to the book yet where Lorgar and the War Master have their falling out. I don't know what book that is.
And not bringing that up.
I know it happens. I know it's a thing. And basically, what's so funny is that Lorgar and Horus have a falling out, and Lorgar does not come to Earth. And it may, you know, the lack of the Word Bearers on Earth could have tipped the balance. Right. And now in the 40th millennium,
the Gall Vorback were there.
Were they?
Yes.
I don't remember any Word Bearers in the...
Because that's when he foresaw his death, the main one.
Yes, but he dies long before that. He dies on one of the Ultramar worlds.
Oh, okay.
Fucking Erebus. And I please edit that. I don't want to have F-bombs in the show. but I love Argal Tal, and Erebus backstabs him and because he's preventing Karn from becoming what he should be for the Ruinous Powers. Argal Tal is a stabilizing force for Karn, and Erebus decides, or is told, it's not really clear which, that Argal Tal's got to go so that Karn can grow into being the berserker that Korn wants him to be. So yeah, yes, that is a thing, that Argal Tal saw that he was going to die on Earth, but in the shadow of something, and he sees that on this world of Ultramar as he
dies. In the shadow of great wings.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. So, Erebus. Oh, I hate you. And I own him now. It's fantastic. He's part of my...
Oh, did you stop him under your boot a couple times just to get it out of your system? I'll do it. I'll be right over.
Yeah.
Okay. So the
story back the lantern up. Run him over again.
Story that I was referencing earlier is called The Sigilite, and it starts with a character named Khalid Hassan.
I've read that. Why do I not remember it?
Well, you do.
I have it on audiobook.
Huh. Okay. Hassan. Right, he's not the same guy from.
I gotta find that one too.
A Thousand Suns and the first Space Wolf book. Is he?
Might be. He may have shown up as a refugee from there. I don't remember.
Okay.
So it may just be they use the same name. It's the same character.
Hassan and Hauser and It's been so long since I've read those books. And I'm not rereading those books because those are some long ass books.
There it is, right there. The Sigilite. All right, I'm gonna go put it in my Google Drive.
All right. So what's our next book? It's your turn, I guess.
No, it's your turn.
It's your turn. Oh. Don't pick this one. I picked the one before.
Well, crap. Yep.
It's your turn.
I'm not ready to pick. All right, so I'll surprise people. I don't know yet.
All
right. I have a thought.
Take a day or two. Figure out what you want to do.
I know. I have it. I want to do Savage Weapons, which is a short story from book 10 of the Dark Angels versus the Night Lords during the Thrawmas Crusade. It's on Sugala, something like that.
Sigalsa.
Thank you.
Yeah, they say it in one of the audio dramas, Sigalsa.
Yes, we're doing that. That is a fantastic story, and it features – it's the first appearance of Sevatar. Really, I mean, he comes up, I think, in the first trilogy, but only by name. You don't really get any measure of him. We're doing that. Savage Weapons.
Nice.
All right, cool.
All right, cool.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Lots of fun. Let's do it again.
All righty.
Bye.
See ya.
See ya.